Organizational resilience is about how we as a company, as a community of people, avoid or absorb disruption, how we navigate through crisis, how we may even adapt to change and survive, not just survive, but thrive through change. Individual resilience, though, we have that inside of us. It's a muscle that we can build. On an organizational level, it's much more than just bringing people who are individually resilient together. It's much more complicated than that.
This is The Change Up. I'm Keith Hernandez. This week's guest is CEO and founder of Melita Advisors, Natasha Kihimkar. Melita Advisors is a strategic advisory firm focusing on areas of diversity, equity, inclusion, organizational change, and scaling your HR function. We talk about her career journey in the pharma world, to tech startups, to building her own thing. She also shares how during the pandemic, she recorded her family's life story, interviewing her mom and dad daily for posterity. All right, excited for my next guest. She is the CEO and founder of Melita Advisors. This is Natasha Kihimkar. Natasha, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm so glad to be here, Keith. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. We're talking right after the U.S. won their first match in the World Cup, so I'm pumped and excited. Tell me a little bit about what Melita Advisors does.
We are a boutique global advisory firm. We center on people, talent, and diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. We also do executive coaching, team coaching, and one-on-one relationship coaching.
Very cool. So how did you get into this? What was the inspiration behind leaving the corporate world and starting your own thing?
Gosh, I spent over 25 years in people, talent, and DEI. I was in chief people officer roles, VPHR, in different size companies and in different industries. And then in 2020, I decided that it was time for a pandemic baby. Interestingly, I had always planned to open my own firm. It just happened to be that was the year. I had a really interesting set of conversations with my parents when COVID hit. My parents were living in Toronto and I'm in the Bay Area. And over the course of the pandemic, instead of using my early morning hours to commute an hour, 20 minutes into the city, I started to record our family stories.
Very cool.
And I had them retell stories that I had heard over the years, not just their own personal stories, but their parents and their grandparents and the ancestors. And so when it was time to start the company, the only name I could think of was Melita Advisors. Melita is a ceremony of Thanksgiving that is unique to our community. And we serve a dish called Melita. And it's a dish that's got these beautiful textures and flavors and colors and scents. And it's just such a lovely mishmash of things. And I thought, that is the beauty of our clients. Mm. That right there is the beauty of our clients. It's such a beautiful mix of things that makes each one of them unique. And it felt in some way both honoring my ancestry, my history, my family history, and honoring our clients at the same time.
What a wonderful, wonderful reason for the name and depth to that story. When you reached out to your parents to talk about these stories, what was their initial reaction? What was the framing device that you used to get them to say yes to something like this?
You know, I've been hearing these stories for so long. I asked them if we could record it. That was a new thing for us.
Yeah.
But I said, you know, I want to write a book. We should write this book. It would probably be just for the family, but let's write a book. And a great way to capture all the stories, I thought, would be let's record it. So that was the impetus for it. They were very excited to do it because I will say it's only 3 hours time difference, but it's enough of a difference to be complicated.
Absolutely.
You know, by the time I'm driving in there, it's already lunchtime for them. Or by the time I'm heading home, it's late. You know, they're not feeling super chatty at that point. And so they were very excited to do it because when I was up, it was 5 a.m. my time, 8 a.m. their time, they're ready to go. So we would talk for 45 minutes to an hour each day. And we did that several days in a row for weeks, months, and told stories that I had heard over and over again, but with additional nuance, with additional color, with a different additional perspective, sometimes maybe revealing more than they had ever revealed before. I think some of it is we're on Zoom, so there's not physical proximity. You're still seeing the person, but there's not physical proximity. And I think it facilitated more open conversation. And also, I'm older, Yeah. And so we also talked about things that they may not have felt comfortable talking about before.
Absolutely. What was their dynamic like, you know, with two people telling a story? Was somebody fact-checking? Was somebody filling in color commentary? How did it work between them in terms of the balance of what they were sharing?
So I interviewed my father telling his family story up until the time he met my mother.
Oh, cool.
And then I interviewed my mother doing the same thing, telling her family story all the way up to the time that she met my dad.
I love that so
much. And then I had the two of them together on camera with me, telling their story now, their joint story. Sometimes we would revisit stories. Sometimes I would get a call or a text that was wrong, or I heard dad say blah, 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 and this is what it actually happened. So sometimes we'd get messages back and forth like that. And sometimes newer stories would interweave with, remember that so-and-so that we talked about, blah, blah, blah. Like,
right.
It all sort of wound together. So I do. I have hours and hours of recordings of my parents telling their stories. It's pretty special. I haven't written the book.
Okay.
But my dad passed away earlier this year.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you, Keith. He passed away in February, but I was left feeling that he said everything that he needed to say.
Was he in bad health when he started recording with you, or was this something completely
different? No, he was fine.
Okay.
It wasn't a terribly, what you would imagine, a serious long illness at all. It was fairly quick. And living 89 years on this planet and seeing all the change in the world and all the different countries that he lived in and visited, he had a full life. And he knew that we loved him and we knew that he loved us.
I could tell you had a close relationship. I can tell that this is a father that was there for you and that you could have honest conversations with.
Yeah, I miss him for sure. I also am, I know he's with me.
Yeah. So you grew up in Toronto or?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Toronto. My parents are from India. They met and married in London. And my father worked for Air India at the time. And so he traveled all over the world. And I used to travel for work as well internationally. So I have pictures of the Kowloon side of Hong Kong that mirror pictures that he took before I was born, and it was farmland.
Wow.
Or a picture of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which now we see it's, you know, a full bridge.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He has a photo, had a photo of it where it wasn't quite connected in the center yet.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So just amazing to be able to visit some of the places that he got to visit. He went to many other parts of the world that I had never been to and vice versa, but we shared a love of travel and a love of learning about different cultures and countries.
It's funny. I didn't travel internationally until 30 years old. And it was just because I don't know. That's just not what my family did. And so I'm a very late bloomer to it. And it's been really fun with my daughter. We just got her passport renewed. She's 7 years old. So her passport was from when she was 3 months old. And so it's been really fun to watch how much she loves travel and how excited she is to do it versus, you know, sometimes you see the fear that some people have of going to see other cultures and going to see other things. Did your family go on family trips together, or was your father just doing a lot of business and kind of bringing home some of those stories and memories?
The travel that he did around the world was mostly before I was born.
Okay.
So before they moved to Toronto, because he was with the airline. So when I was growing up, we couldn't really afford to do travel like that. We did road trips, if anything. And so what we would do is we used to have this giant atlas at home. Remember paper atlases?
Yeah.
A giant atlas. And we'd open up the atlas. And he had an old suitcase that had this amazing little clicky sound that you'd flip the buttons and it would click open. And imagine it's sort of not quite plastered, but quite heavily stickered with all these different stickers from all over the world. We would open it up and inside was a scattering of photographs, old menus from the first class cabin in Air India, autograph books, everything. We would look through that every now and again and look on the map. Where did he go? Where was this taken? Where is Egypt? Where is Moscow? Where is this place? Where is that place? And that was our way of traveling.
That's so fun. That's so cool. Well, if you don't write the book, it's such a great memory to have, and it's such a great thing to share. Have you shared some of it with other family members? Have they participated in it as well, besides your mother and father?
You know, I haven't. I have a younger brother. I really should ask him if he wants to see it. We haven't talked about it. I know he'll want to see it. We loved our dad, and we love our mom very much. I know he'll want to see it. I also have to bring myself to access the files.
Have you not listened to them since?
I have not listened to them since.
Oh, yeah. That'll be a very special moment for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. So you started the company in 2020, and what was the intention? What were you seeing in the corporate world? I won't get into the exact things that were happening at particular companies, but what were you seeing that was kind of in need that corporate companies were not doing that you thought, you know what, if I go out on my own, I could actually accomplish this?
I think the thing I was seeing was that people in organizations, leaders in organizations, they have the mechanics. They know how to do things, but there's something getting in the way of them actually doing it.
That's a great point.
So for example, people have learned over time how to give feedback. There are methods that you can use and training that you can go to and practices that you can employ to give and receive feedback, to share and receive feedback. And yet they're not doing it. And I believed that our firm could marry mindset and technique, that we could bring together perspective and experience that we have, because our team, we're about 14 people now. We've worked across 35 countries, I think, last time I checked. And we believe that we could bring perspective to our clients that would help them get past any obstacles that are getting in the way of them really reaching their full potential. I am an optimist at heart. I do believe that we have the capacity to grow and develop and learn new tricks. But I also recognize that often our biggest limiting factors are in our heads.
Absolutely. Such a great point. So at this point, we're now 2.5 years into COVID, this new world and this new reality of it. And so many companies are going through so many different things. Your experience from different industries and different sized companies equips you to kind of understand what is resilience. And I would love to understand from you, what does resilience look like in the corporate culture, in the corporate world?
So on a personal level, on an individual level, resilience is about our ability to navigate the unknown, right? Thrive through change. On an organizational level, organizational resilience is about how we as a company, as a community of people, avoid or absorb disruption, how we navigate through crisis, how we may even adapt to change and survive, not just survive, but thrive through change. Individual resilience, though, we have that inside of us. Mm-hmm. It's a muscle that we can build. On an organizational level, it's much more than just bringing people who are individually resilient together. It's much more complicated than that.
You know, so often people, for personal resilience, right, they talk about it as something innate or something preternatural that you've kind of have because of generational trauma or generational strength that gets you there. But is resilience something that you can learn? Is resilience something that can be taught?
Resilience is absolutely a muscle that can be built. It's maybe something you're born with, but it's definitely something that you can amplify. When we think about resilience, we need to think about how we have a capacity to manage change, to think about how we might actually go through a difficult situation or the unknown. So just a gray area that is uncertain to us. What information do we seek? What areas can we control? These are things that we can learn how to deal with unexpected setbacks. These are things that we can get better and better at navigating, that we can realize that we have networks that we can tap into, either in our immediate circle, people around us, absolutely, or even within our own selves. So maybe I need to have a moment where I'm just practicing some mindfulness right now as a way absolutely to recharge and give myself some time to think. There are many practices that we can employ when it comes to resilience. And on an individual level, I think when we don't believe we are resilient, we haven't really thought about our true capacity and not realizing our true potential.
Okay. So we've defined resilience in a corporate setting, but we all know companies love to measure things. So how do we measure resilience?
Well, Keith, interestingly, we've identified what we call the biomarkers of organizational resilience. These are the signs. So biomarkers are like medical signs. They influence and they predict whether a specific outcome or condition exists.
Okay.
Similarly, in organizational resilience, we've identified certain biomarkers. So these include things like how conflict is managed, leadership team effectiveness, inclusion. These are just a sample of some of the things that we've identified as these critical signs, the biomarkers that contribute to organizational resilience. If you focus on them, you'll build a company that can thrive through challenges.
How do you get a company to buy into something like that? That sounds like not only does senior leadership have to fully throated say, this is something that we're going to do, but HR has to be part of it all the way through. So how do you get the buy-in?
One of the big challenges we have is that people in organizations will treat things like inclusion or leadership team effectiveness or conflict or manager effectiveness. They treat it like a project.
Yeah. Special project.
Exactly.
When extracurricular.
Like a special project.
Yeah.
It's extracurricular. So what ends up not mattering? The extracurricular, the project. When we start integrating and make it part of the day-to-day, so you will not do a team meeting without taking certain steps on inclusion. You will not schedule an all hands without thinking about purpose. We look to integrate these into the day-to-day so that they become habits and that companies can sustain these going forward. If we keep treating it like a special project, they're always going to need outside help. And right. While that might be great for my bottom line, it's not great for continuity in the company. We want these things to become part of the DNA and the habits of a company, not dependent on whether Natasha's there or Keith's there or somebody else is there. When we win the lottery and move to Tahiti, it should continue, right? These patterns and habits should continue. That's what we look for. We look for opportunities to integrate it into the day-to-day.
Absolutely. And you know, you mentioned a little earlier about your father passing. And I think before we started recording, I shared my father passed in 2017, rather unexpectedly. My father-in-law passed Christmas 2019. And there is that trauma that happens with it, but there is that resilience. And I think there is a dynamic between getting back to work. And I don't want to say getting over, because we'll never get over the relationship that we had with our fathers, right? So it's not that. It is just about like finding that resilience to continue through. And I'd love to hear your personal story and your personal journey with starting a company right as something like that happened.
You know, it's interesting. We have this desire to want to help people when they're experiencing pain or sadness. We want to make things better for them. And for those of us experiencing the loss, we want to be in the loss. We want to feel it, but we may not be ready to feel all of it all at once. And so for some of us, like what I did turn to work, you know, building a company at the same time and a mom and a friend. And, you know, we have a lot of hats that we all wear.
Absolutely.
Work is one way that we can channel our energy and escape for a little while from what may be a very difficult experience. It's also a way that we can honor the people that we lost.
Absolutely. I love that.
I lost my uncle earlier this year. He passed away just over a month ago now. And he was a really successful business leader. He worked really, really hard and he was really proud of me. And I felt very comforted by work because I felt that in a way, my working and my striving for success in my business was a way of honoring my Uncle Sam.
During these times of difficulty, right? Like one of the things that I struggle with, and I reflect and remember back on it now, because I was still big company. I was at Warner Media, which was like thousands, tens of thousands of people when my father passed. I just went inward. I didn't know how to share that with others. And I don't know if I shared with you, he died between Hurricanes Irma and Maria in Puerto Rico. Oh. So people knew, it was on the news. He was one of the 3,300, but I just didn't know how to talk about it. And I didn't know how to relate it to anybody. So how did you as a leader share that with your team and allow them to kind of join you a little bit in the building back up of who you are?
Well, first, I'm really sorry about your loss.
Thank
as
you.
Well.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't get easier.
It doesn't. It really doesn't.
I don't
right?
think that's a thing. At least it's not for me. You know, I'm blessed to work with people who are exceptional human beings and happen, most of them, to be coaches and advisors. Their role is to approach each other with empathy, but that doesn't mean getting into the pain fully with you and making it, trying to make it better for you. As coaches, we do deliberately manage some separation to help somebody process what they need to process in the way they need to process it. They didn't ever come in to help me fix things or make me feel better. They wanted me to feel cared for, that I was surrounded by warmth, but it wasn't with the aim of making the pain go away. And I thought that for me, that was a beautiful, beautiful experience.
Yeah.
I wasn't always able to acknowledge it at the time because I was still processing, but what an opportunity for appreciation. I was just surrounded by people who cared. It was beautiful.
What an important distinction. And I love that answer. Talk to me a little bit about this team. They sound magical. How did you find and how do you recruit people for your team?
So a few of the people I've known for a very long time. We've either worked together before or have gone to grad school together. So there's quite some history. A few folks, we actually went through the same coaching program, but in different cities, different states. But there's a bit of a common language that we use. It's very interesting. It's sort of a magnet for us in terms of how we see the world and how we process challenges or opportunities. The others, you know, I actually posted in some groups that I'm a part of to see if there would be anybody who was interested. And then we went through an interview process. I am trusting that folks have, you know, once they have certain credentials, that helps a lot. But I also shared our company values as a way of finding out whether we had connection in terms of what mattered to us.
Yeah.
So the company values is actually a really good test for that when I tell a story about our values.
This week's episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. For the past 6 months, I've literally taken it every single day. I started taking AG1 because I wanted more energy and didn't want to have to load up on dozens of supplements. Every morning, I get the coffee going, then make my AG1, and try to drink it before my jog jumps on my lap asking for a walk outside. It's a great start to the day. Since drinking AG1, I've noticed a boost in energy and the ability to bounce from working, taking my daughter to her soccer, gymnastics, baseball, field hockey practices. We got to figure out which sport she actually loves. It's super simple. You take one scoop of AG1 and you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source, superfoods, probiotic, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is giving you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Those are really good if you're traveling for business, and I have been using them a lot. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/changeup. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/changeup to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutrition insurance. I've seen this, at least on the advertising side, so it might be a little bit different for you. When these kind of consortiums of advisors get together, there's a lot of leaders and a lot of egos, but it doesn't sound like that's happening there. How do you manage that and make sure, like, you know, the people that are joining who have had successful careers elsewhere understand how they're part of this community, part of your company? But there's got to be somebody in charge, right? There's got to be somebody in charge.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that. I think the fact that most of us are coaches helps.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we have no ego, by the way.
Okay.
But there is this understanding that we are all pretty self-aware.
Cool.
We know we're imperfect. We know what areas we need to get better in. And we also know that we can all be following the exact same formula or the same recipe, but the food's going to taste a little bit different.
Right.
We all bring our own special spices. So to think that we're competing in that way, it's not really the way we operate. And we all have slightly different specialties too.
Right.
So Okay. It's actually quite complementary.
Very cool. So let's now go the other way with that, right? So you built this team and now you're out there looking for clients to say yes to Melita Advisors. Many leaders can, you know, have that empathy, awareness, that EQ to go, okay, our team could function a little bit better, right? Like there could be something that we can do here that can do that. And they know that an outside impartial resource will be a great asset for them. But when should they bring that up, right? Like one of the things that when I talk to, you know, I'm not a coach and I'm not certified to do this, but I talk to a lot of people who are in these positions and they're vulnerable because they don't want to share that too early with their boss because they don't want it to seem like a weakness that they don't have control of their team, but they don't want to share it too late where their boss has already recognized that it's a weakness, and now this is a last-ditch effort, right? So how do they find that sweet spot to bring this challenge to your team?
You know, it's so interesting that many organizations say the most important thing and the most important ingredient for success for our company is our team. It's our leadership team or whatever, our working team. And yet they don't want to invest in the team.
Right. They don't.
It's very curious. I was at a conference actually, and they had these dots that they asked people who were participating in the conference to stick on a wall. So what size company are you? We're primarily startups, early stage startups, you know, 1 to 50 people. What's the most important key to success for your company? Team. So wait a second. You're telling me that the 1 to 50 is the bulk of the people in this conference who stuck stickers on the wall, and they think the team is the most important.
Right.
So what's the right time to bring in somebody to help you with your team effectiveness? I think it's the 1 to 50.
Yeah.
Maybe not one, but certainly when you have a team size of 4.
Okay.
It's a good time to start thinking about it. And it's interesting because I've talked to VC talent partners. I talked to one in Boston and I talked to one here in the Bay Area. And both of them said they have a difficult time getting founder CEOs to invest in team alignment early. And they really wish they would.
Yeah.
Because the problems that happen, they can almost predict it.
Yeah. Did they go that next step and ask why a CEO wouldn't invest in it? Do these CEOs just think that'll work itself out, or it's too early and we got other problems?
They think it's too early. They think their challenge tends to be either recruiting or some other issue that's coming up. If they're going to invest on the people and talent side, it's not going to be in team alignment. I think part of it is, I wonder if they feel selfish. That if they spend it on themselves, that it's going to be to the detriment of the team or detriment of the company. When in fact, and especially now when we're in very turbulent times, especially in tech, investing in the team, in your executive team right now is the thing to do. Why?
Absolutely.
Because when there is pressure and tension, that's when the cracks that you were sort of pretending not to notice, they turn into chasms. And if you want your company to succeed and survive and thrive, you need a cohesive team. You do not need a fractured team. But I can assure you, if you don't address it and don't start doing more than Band-Aid work on a team that's got some cracks in it, those cracks turn into chasms really, really quickly.
So let's talk about some of those chasms, right? Where I think it switched really fast this year, where there was just a sliver of employee empowerment where people could kind of raise up and say, we need more, we're looking for more. And then in the last, was it been 2 to 3 weeks, there's been tens of thousands of people hit in the tech sector with layoffs, most prominently in the Bay Area where you live. What should people who are trying to balance that, right? They might not be the C-suite, they might be VP, or they might be senior director level, and they know that there could be more done at the company and that there's more that can be done to kind of keep people here. What should they be doing? How can they raise that in such a fraught environment right now where so many people are getting laid off and so many companies are downsizing?
There are a couple of things that come to mind, and I do want to acknowledge this is a really difficult time for people.
Yeah.
I think the first thing is, we, I think, did somewhat of a disservice to people managers in particular when we spoke so much about empathy and didn't really teach people how to engage in that, in conversations with empathy. We created a little bit of a monster, I think, in that we asked people to lean very heavily on making space for people and giving people an opportunity to express themselves or be quiet, whatever it was. But we flexed very heavily in that direction, but we neglected to say it's in the context of performance and productivity.
Right.
So we gave people, again, a one-sided version of our people leaders. People leaders who focus way too much on performance and productivity and lose the empathy side, that's not helpful either. But we leaned too much. If you look at what was published in the last few years, especially articles about needing to be vulnerable and empathy, people leaders sort of struggled to find balance there.
Absolutely.
And so I think getting centered on what the right balance is between empathy or with empathy and productivity, and not maybe not balancing them, but actually integrating them, That is what great leaders do. They are empathetic leaders who are capable and very willing and effective at having conversations about productivity and performance. What's going to make you even better, right? Very capable at doing that. So that's, I think, one element. I think the other element that we have to think about is something really simple, and that's stay interviews.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of recruiters have been impacted in this time. And I wonder if some organizations might not benefit from having their recruiters help their people leaders re-recruit the employees they have.
I love that. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. Re-recruiting is, and having stay interviews are finding out the skills and experiences and expertise that people have and figuring out how best to let those folks actually apply them in the jobs that they have. How many of us have had the experience where we come in with a stellar resume,
right,
all this great experience, and then you come in and you're going to do that piece and only that piece and don't go beyond it. And thank you very much, all the rest of your experience. We don't need that right now. It's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
But because we're not really embracing everybody's full expertise and skills and career interests, by the way, we don't get everything that someone can bring to us. Now, this doesn't mean I'm suggesting that people allow or enable team members to leapfrog in their career. I do believe performance is your ticket to entry, right?
Absolutely.
We're not going to talk about the next opportunity unless you have a track record of success. But I wonder if the opportunity for us is to find out what's missing for people in the roles that they have so that we can get the most productivity and the most engagement from them.
It's a little bit of a tightrope, right, in the current setting. Because if you go to a company that might not have the best culture and say, okay, HR is going to institute this thing where we're going to bring you in and you're going to tell us what else you want in your job, it can really quickly turn into a bitch fest, right?
Yeah.
Or it can really turn sour quickly. So how do you equip an HR team to handle that, to say, this is about the success and how you can continue your success here versus this is how we solve some of the problems that you have day to day, right? Like, how do you make sure that you walk that tightrope to get the best out of people and find their strengths?
The opportunity here is not to talk about what else can we give you. It's where else do your needs and interests align with the company's needs and interests?
Great point. Okay.
It's in service of.
Excellent. You talked about performance and productivity. This might kind of fall into that. Snap today announced they are looking to have 80% return to office, meaning it sounds like 4 out of 5 days, right? If you do the math on that, like work from home Fridays. This has been a wild 2.5 years. And, you know, 3 years ago this time I was sitting in an office. I had my own office and I am very social. I like going out and seeing people, but I also like working at home. It's also really nice and fun and cozy. I can do interviews like this at any time. What's your point of view on return to office, how the working dynamic is, especially around performance and productivity? Because I see it as kind of a little bit of fear in some leadership that, you know, we don't know what our team is doing, so we do need them back. But I'd love your take on this.
I had the honor of working with a company that was 100% remote. It was born remote and is deliberately remote. And that's their whole thing. They are remote and they're very, very effective globally, by the way. They've done an exceptional job of maintaining community and connection. Their mastery of asynchronous work is, you know, something to write home about for sure. I am not convinced that being in person is the answer. Not just because of that one client, but I'll remind everybody that we had problems when we were inside the office as well.
Absolutely.
Those problems did not disappear when we went remote. And they don't kind of magically disappear when we go back into the office. This concern that managers have, and it's typically managers, it was a study done by Microsoft. I want to say it came out last month about leadership desire to return to office versus employer or earlier career people wanting to return to office. And there's quite a gap between them.
Absolutely.
Leaders really want it. Employees, not so much. And leaders don't believe that their people are as productive. The employees themselves think they're highly productive. I think the gap is we do not know how to manage people effectively.
Mm-hmm. Great point.
That's a big statement, I know. That's a kind of in your face. I get it. But if we really understood the work that people do, the way they can do it most effectively, and how to coach them for that, I have a feeling that these fears of so-and-so's not working hard wouldn't be as present for us.
I 100% agree with you. The joke I always make about this is, you know, the fear that a lot of upper management have, is kind of like if you watch a horror movie, right? Like if you never see the monster or you never see the ghost, you're more scared than if you see kind of a head bouncing down a wall or you see blood everywhere. You go, oh, I can see the seams through that, right? I can see kind of how silly that is. And I see how they made the movie magic there. But when you don't see the monster, you get really scared. And I think that's what happens to upper management a lot, is they don't see what their employees are doing. So they imagine the worst. They imagine them taking 9-hour breaks and only working 1 hour because they don't see the output. And it's a little easier when they're in person.
Well, we're human. And one of the things we learn in our coaching program is when there's a problem with me, I typically will blame the environment. When there's a problem with you, there's something wrong with your core.
Oh man.
So it's really interesting that, you know, maybe we should turn the mirror and take a look at ourselves and see how productive are we. What's getting in the way of us being more productive? It's usually not that I don't get to see people all the time.
Yeah, that's true. So 14 coworkers, you're all remote right now?
We are all remote.
Cool. And what does growth look like for you? Do you anticipate the next couple of years to grow to more people, more partners?
I'm pretty comfortable with the company at this size. You know, we all have other interests as well. And I want to make sure that I'm respectful of my team's time and capacity. But I enjoy working with every single one of them. It's exciting. We have experience across multiple industries. And so when you talk about growth in the future for us, we see the opportunity to take our experience in one industry and apply it to others as well. So while today most of our clients are in tech and biotech, we're not limited to those industries. We have a bespoke approach in our organization. We don't apply a playbook to our clients. We don't think it's one size fits all. One of our values is perspective, and another is curiosity. And the way those play out for us is we always want to understand the nuance and connection in our client organizations. And also that the perspectives and experiences we've had, they help give us a filter or a lens on what a client might be experiencing that can be pretty unique. And so that bespoke mindset, I think, will allow us to expand to other industries as well.
We didn't talk about this, and I do want to get to it because it's fun. How did you land your first client?
My first client was actually, I had reached out to someone just to wish them happy holidays. Nice. And it was somebody I had worked with before. And they said, hey, you know, I think we may need to talk to you. I see that you started something, so let's connect. And I said, sure. And it turned into a lovely engagement. Any opportunity I have to help someone that I know and care for be even more successful, I'm happy to do it. The first one was, it's a labor of love. You know, we love the work we do and we care deeply about our clients. We want to make them successful. That's our whole goal. We want to make them look good.
Absolutely.
So the opportunity to do that for someone I already knew was beautiful.
Such a good reminder too, because I think those small things are huge. Sending notes to people, keeping connected, saying, hey, how have you been, matter, right? I think some people forget that, right? Especially if they're working in a sales or a marketing or a role where it's about productivity, you forget to kind of stop and say, I should reach out to that person. I should say hi. It matters.
So Keith, this is actually something that matters to me very, very deeply. In every conversation, my goal is simply to add value.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make a sale. I'm not trying to upsell. It's not about that. If it's an idea, if it's an article that I can share, if it's a referral I can make, a connection that I can introduce you to somebody who could help, or if we have a solution that might help you, as long as your world is made better after our conversation, I'm happy. So I go in simply with the intention of adding value. It's not to achieve something specific. And so it makes my day wonderful. Every day is wonderful.
It's so well put. And it's so honest. I love it so much. You talked a little bit about having more than just the work. and you shared with me a little bit about your family. Do you feel comfortable talking about your kids and the family that you've built and created there? Because I think it's a beautiful story.
Yeah. So our kids are now 12 and 13. They're both middle schoolers. We adopted our kids from South Korea. My husband and I had a long and winding road for family building. And we adopted from South Korea. Our kids, we adore them. They're just amazing. And we added to the family by, we got a puppy this year. So little Roti is running around the house and making us all really happy.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. It's so amazing that you've done the adoption. I shared with you the first time that we talked. We fostered for a little bit. It was a 5-day old and for a year and a half. And it's just the respect that I have for people that reach out with their heart and welcome people into their home and build that family it's outsized. So thank you for doing that. And I can tell how warm-hearted you are and how amazingly welcome you are to bring that in. And that they're lucky to have you. That's really, really cool.
Oh, thank you. I hope they agree.
Well, now that they're teenagers, they might disagree, right? They'll come back around in their 20s and be like, oh, that was awesome. So I love, as I get near the end of the conversation, asking this question to kind of wrap it up and put a little bow on it. If we were to catch up, and I hope we do catch up more than just next time in a year, but if we were to catch up in a year, what do you hope to be most proud of professionally, personally, with the company or with your personal growth over the next year?
Well, professionally, our team goal is to help clients build their org resilience muscles and help executive teams build outstanding cohesion that will enable them and their orgs to thrive, even and maybe even especially in times of turbulence. On a personal level, we'll be going through some transitions next year. Our kids will be having their bar and bat mitzvahs, and we hope to take them to visit their birthplaces as well. And our eldest will also be heading to high school. So my wish is just for each of those experiences to be really special and really uplifting.
Oh, that will be. With the intention that you have, that'll be amazing. I love that so much. So how can people find out more about Melita Advisors? How can they get in contact with you if they want to have a conversation?
Oh, thank you. Well, obviously visit our website. We're at melitaadvisors.com. We're also on LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want to reach me, I'm at natasha@melitaadvisors.com.
Amazing. Natasha, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you sharing so much. I think there were some powerful insights here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Keith. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Change Up, produced by Elena Weedland, with original music by Rodney Hazard. If you liked what you heard, we'd appreciate your support by liking, sharing, leaving a comment, and subscribing wherever you listen. Thanks once again. Until next time.